Hello, welcome to my channel, Anglican Aesthetics. In this podcast episode, I also wanted to test out another app just to see how it goes, so there it is. But in this podcast episode, I wanted to follow up on a debate I did with the other Paul, with Paul Facey, on whether Christian governments, whether the government, rather, in principle, should punish non-Christian expressions of belief. And if you're raised in America, you might think that that's kind of an odd debate topic. Why would we punish non-Christian beliefs? What I want to do in this podcast episode is articulate the sort of issues that generate the need for us as Christians to think carefully about what we call political theology, the theology of interaction with the polis, of how should we as Christians implement publicly our faith in Christ in the policy of the state, in the state, in public. How should we think about the interaction between faith and politics? So what generates this sort of issues, this sort of set of issues? Well, I want you to think with me about something you may have heard. We, for example, suppose someone says to you, well, the reason we shouldn't be so hard on illegal immigrants is because God cares for the sojourner. And because God cares for the sojourner, shows hospitality, Christians should vote for policies that seek to show hospitality. I'm sure you've probably heard of an argument maybe along those lines before. And I just want to highlight the assumption, not stating whether that assumption is right or wrong yet, but just to highlight the underlying assumption there. The underlying assumption is that the state is for the implementation of God's heart, of God's vision of justice. And if one makes that argument, then they'll either need a delimiting principle for why we should implement some aspects of God's heart and his vision for justice and not others, or they might go all the way. Certain Christian nationalists kind of go all the way with this. You might have, so on the right, I'm not talking about Christian nationalism quite yet. On the right, you may have heard, we should care about restricting immigration because Scripture commands us to seek the good of the city that we're in. And again, that operates under this sort of same assumption, that the state is, to some extent or another, for the implementation of God's vision of justice. So what we need to do as Christians then is to ask, okay, how, to what extent is the government for the implementation of God's vision of justice? Those on the left, for instance, would, or those generally speaking, against mass restrictions on immigration, would be pro-religious freedom. And yet Christians believe that worshiping false gods is a grave evil. It is not morally neutral to be a Muslim, to be a Hindu, to be a polytheist. It is to commit a grave evil. Now, the Christian nationalist comes in and says, you know what? We're just going to go down the whole line here. If it's true that the government is for the implementation of God's justice in the public sphere, Christians should then seek to implement that all the way down the line. And so you'll have Christian nationalists like Stephen Wolfe saying we should outlaw, as a matter of public policy, idolatrous expressions of faith towards God, because if the government secures the public and common good, but the common good is the assimilation of the community to the life of God, then the state should punish things that are contrary to assimilation to the life of God. That's the sort of basic underlying argument here. And it requires us to think carefully about how the state exactly operates as the servant of God. In Romans 13, all of us read that the government is appointed to punish evil and praise the good. But the problem is that none of us even the Christian nationalist, generally speaking, takes that in an utterly absolute sense. The Christian nationalist, very few of them anyway, will very rarely argue that the state should force people to get baptized. Even if we agree that refusing to get baptized is an evil. In other words, they have a delimiting principle as well about the extent to which the government implements God's justice. So what I want to do is sketch out a paradigm I'm calling Christic liberalism. Christic liberalism takes some cues from the political tradition of classical liberalism. Now, classical liberalism thought that the government was for the securing of the freedom of its people, with the proviso that the government punishes those exercises of freedom which impinge or restrict the freedom of others. So, for instance, why is it that in a classically liberal state, and I'm not using the word liberal in terms of leftist political theory or something like this, but in terms of the political tradition of thought, liberalism. America's is a roughly classical liberal state. So why is it, for instance, that in America, we punish stealing, maybe even stealing a Twizzler, and we don't punish adultery? Okay, so arguably, I'd say, cheating on your spouse is morally way worse than stealing a Twizzler. But we punish one and not the other. Now, some have tried to say, well, because the government doesn't punish moral evils. But of course, stealing a Twizzler is also a moral evil, right? But it's a moral evil of a lesser order than adultery, even though in a classically liberal state you punish stealing a Twizzler and you don't punish adultery. Well, why is that? Because in the sort of founding political theory of America, which draws largely from classical liberalism, the government punishes exercises of freedom that impinge on the freedom of another. Stealing is stealing precisely because it is against the consent of the owner of the said good. What you're doing is you're violating the exercise of their agency. So the delimiting principle under classical liberalism for which rights and which wrongs the government punishes is the exercise of freedom and the exercise of freedom as it pertains to impinging upon the freedom of others. The government punishes those exercises of freedom that impinge or restrict the freedom of others in a classically liberal state. And hence you punish stealing a 5-cent Twizzler and not adultery, even though adultery is way worse, because only one of those is is a violation of the exercise of the freedom of another. Okay, so here's the sort of places where classical liberalism, I think, innovates, and the places where I think it is continuous, generally speaking. Now, under John Locke, Locke had argued, so what are sort of the foundations for classical liberalism? Well, prior to classical liberalism, most thinkers, even pagan thinkers, non-Christian thinkers, thought that the government was for, broadly speaking, the implementation of public virtue. So the government facilitates the virtue of its people. You find this actually in the Politics of Aristotle, in Book 1, that the government or the state is not just for the facilitating of living together, but for the facilitation of living well together. You find this in Plato, where Plato then takes this to advocate for forms of censorship because he thinks that there are forms of poetry or art that are bad for public virtue, so the government should essentially outlaw them. You find this in medieval thinkers, Aquinas. You find this in Reformation thinkers, Richard Hooker, Hugo Grotius to some extent. Now, John Locke comes along. Now, he's not the only classical liberal thinker, but I focus on him to sort of show one of the places that I think is a little bit of a novelty. classical liberals, John Locke argues that the political state is not continuous, actually, with the state of nature. You see, for Aristotle, the reason we form states, it's because statehood is really just kind of a continuation or the perfection of the principle of being a social animal. When he says man is by nature a political animal, he's pointing out the fact that human beings naturally are social. We form groups, and we form groups not just because we're, you know, seeking protection or seeking utilitarian goods or to whatever. We just sort of naturally form goods, the groups that seems to be part of the way we achieve well-being as humans. And of course, forming groups is part of the way we secure our bodily life. Now, for John Locke, he thought that, well, actually, government states are contrary to a state of nature. You see, in a state of nature, in a pre-political state, everyone is essentially on their own, okay? Everyone, no matter who you are, is essentially fending for themselves. And as such, as an individual, prior to the existence of a state, you have a right to avenge the wrongs done on you. So if someone murders you, if someone murders you, you're just dead. but if someone murders your child or something like this, right? In a pre-political state, according to John Locke, you have a right to go ahead and seek revenge yourself. You don't have to wait for, say, a state to intervene on your behalf. You can just go ahead and seek vengeance. Okay. So that's a little bit, you know, so that's interesting. So you can go ahead and kill the offender yourself. What's the reason we form political states? Well, there are certain rights that we have as people that, for Locke, are guaranteed in a political state. So someone surrenders certain rights, for instance, the right to avenge themselves, in order to join a state, because certain rights like life, like liberty, like property, natural rights for Locke, are better guaranteed in a state. But the state, on this view, isn't sort of the natural telos or the natural goal of human society. It's a remedial measure that we kind of take in light of the fact that securing things like life, liberty, and property is easier in a state than in a political state than in a state of nature. So there's a departure there from the way political theorists thought about the state. Now, the place of continuity that classical liberalism had with the older traditions is that they thought that the state was then formed by the free consent of a people to live a common life together. Now, a lot of people actually who start to do political research think that this part is a modern idea. So if you've ever heard the social contract written by Rousseau, it is often claimed that, well, for the first time in the modern history, people thought that the government and statehood was a social contract, that government derives from the consent of the people. The problem with that telling is that that's actually not where classical liberalism innovates. Where it innovates is this idea that the political state is not natural to human community. But this claim that government deriving from the consent of the people is somehow unique to liberalism is actually just false. And Rousseau, I think, also notes this, but not just Rousseau. You have other classically liberal thinkers, or proto-classical liberals anyway, like Hugo Grotius acknowledging that, to medieval thinkers acknowledging that. Richard Hooker all the way to Aquinas acknowledging, and then Aristotle in Book 3 of the Politics, that a polis, or a state, is formed through the adoption of a constitution. In other words, for Aristotle, Richard Hooker, Thomas Aquinas, etc., the purpose of the state is to secure a common life, to secure the existence of a common life as it is concretized in the form outlined in a state's constitution. Now, a constitution, a written constitution, is the writing down of a prior reality for Aristotle. Constitution, first and foremost, refers to form, the sort of form by which the state has organized its common life, the common life of its citizenship. But for Aristotle and Aquinas and Richard Hooker, then, because the state comes into being through this constitution, which then gets written down and concretized in a written constitution, the government is formed as a polis, as a society of people who have covenanted to live together. And so the idea that government, at least to one extent or another, derives from the consent of the people is actually not where Rousseau innovates. Where he innovates in the social contract is by stating that the governmental will is the expression or the aggregate of the will of the people. So for him, the government or the state ought to take those actions, which basically is kind of an average of the will of the people. So if you have some people who say we should restrict immigration, like full stop, immigration is all bad, and other people who are like we should have no borders, Rousseau is like, okay, well, that means the legislator needs to take a mediating position. That's where he innovates. And classical liberalism isn't committed to that, though some of that language and some of that way of thinking is present in the classical liberal tradition of thought. Okay, so that's some of the sort of political history there. Christic liberalism, the paradigm I'm advocating for, suggests the following. I agree with pre-classical thinkers that the political state is actually natural. It's the telos of human community. Humans, I think, form commonwealths, or they form societies naturally of their own accord. Yes, to attain those goods that are requisite to our bodily life, of course, but also because we're intrinsically social. We find it better to live together, to share a common life with those around us. And so with the pre-moderns, I think they have that right. And then there are certain classical liberals that take that line over the line sketched by John Locke. Jacques Maritain would be a Catholic thinker in the generally political liberal tradition who affirms this. Now, given that the state regulates common life that has come together under the form of a constitution, which is then concretized in a written constitution, the state then is for the protection of that common life as it is delimited by and delineated in the state's constitution. Now, in other words, when we look at the history of political thought, and this is my own comments here, this isn't necessarily in defense of classical liberalism, but I'm sort of teeing up Christic liberalism here. If we look at the history of political thought, the government, what we learn from Aristotle, what we learn from medieval thinkers again, Aquinas, Marsilius of Padua, what we learn from Hugo Grotius in his Prolegomena, or his preface rather, to On the Laws of War and Peace, what we learn from Baron de Montesquieu in his work The Spirit of the Laws, is that governmental societies come together through and for the protection and preservation of a common life. And a common life is structured, right? It has form and order. My common life with, let's say, my company that I work with, is structured by the aims and goals of that institution. The common life of a state is similarly structured by its constitutional form. That's as far as political philosophy, to my mind, gets you. That it's for the protection of a common life as stipulated through a constitution, and as such, the government punishes goods, or punishes evil and appraises goods that are pertinent to the preservation of that common life as it is outlined in constitutional form. So Aristotle in book 5 of the Politics actually talks a little bit about this, that the actions a legislator can take should be delimited by the constitutional form of a state. And I think that's exactly right. This is why, for instance, in a democracy, you might punish a legislator for not abiding by the will of the people, even though in other sorts of states you might not be, in theocracies or whatever. That's as far as political thought gets you, in my mind. So then, what we're free to say as Christians, as the church, is if it's true that the government is for the preservation and sustenance of a common life, as outlined in constitutional form, and I've not derived that from the innovations of classical liberalism, I've actually derived that from pre-modern political thought that extends into classical liberals that at least reject Locke at this point. If that's what government is for, that's what it does, then what we can say as Christians, the question we can ask is this: what form of common life should I share with my neighbor that best enables the mission of the church, that best enables the church to be who she is called to be under the demands of the new covenant? Well, who is she called to be under the demands of the new covenant? You know, my argument in my debate with Paul, what I believe is that the church is called to be a sacrament and icon of God's free offer of reconciliation through embodying the cruciform life of Christ. St. Paul in 2 Corinthians 3 and 4, right, writes about how he holds the treasure of the gospel in jars of clay. The form of life that he takes mirrors the form of the Messiah, in that St. Paul suffers for his pagan contemporaries that he's trying to reach. He suffers for his Jewish countrymen that he's trying to reach, in order that they might share in the riches of the gospel. So the form of life the church is called to have is one of laying down her life for the life of the world as Christ laid down his life for her life. And so then the question we want to ask is, okay, what government structures best enable us to maintain a common life with our neighbors that sort of enables this form of life wherein the church shines as a beacon of laying down her life for the life of her enemies as Christ laid down his life for the life of his enemies? And my contention is that it is actually a broadly liberal one, a governmental form that is committed to securing the freedom of its people, that with the proviso, of course, with liberalism, that the government punishes those exercises of freedom that impinge on the freedom of others, because the icon of God's free offer of reconciliation itself requires that the one to whom I communicate this free offer has enough robust freedom to respond. That is to say, if I am the icon of God's offer of reconciliation, which calls and summons people to Christ, but in that very summons, as the condition for the possibility of that summons, allows for a robust kind of freedom that is poised to either reject or accept Christ's offer of reconciliation, in the form of common life I should seek to have with the state is one that does likewise, is one that seeks to secure for my neighbor a kind of common life that enables my neighbor the sort of robust freedom to respond to the form of life and the communication of the form of life in the church in which she lays down her life as an icon and image and communication of God's free offer of reconciliation in Jesus Christ. So that's sort of an introduction to Christic liberalism here. In future podcast episodes and on my channel as well, I plan to actually give a kind of robust framing of Christic liberalism, hopefully one day to write on it in a robust way as well. But this sort of hopefully primes the pump for starting to think about these issues of how Christians should interact with the state. And so then under Christic liberalism, as a sort of concluding thought here, it would follow that we wouldn't punish non-Christians for expressing counter beliefs against Christ, because that is also an exercise of the very selfsame freedom they need to reject or accept the call of Jesus Christ. But I've made that case in my debate with Paul. I've made that case elsewhere. I'll link those cases in the show notes. And again, I plan to do a more extensive video presentation on that as well. But until next time, God bless. Thank you so much for watching.